So good to see you all. Welcome back to the class on the six perfections. So let's begin as we normally do. So make sure you're comfortable in your seat. Your back is straight. Maybe take a couple of breaths and become aware of your breathing. And while your awareness is on the breath, anywhere within the body, imagine that from the 10 directions of space, the spiritual lineage of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear in the space above your head. And then imagine that every other sentient being is sitting around you. And recollect what we have in common with every other sentient being, that we equally wish to avoid suffering, equally wish to be happy, yet equally lack genuine happiness. Furthermore, we are equal in the fact that the causes of suffering can be eliminated and the potential for a complete, genuine happiness can be actualized. Complete, genuine happiness is dependent upon us practicing the six perfections. And by doing so, we can help everyone else turn their mind towards the Dharma and to practice the Dharma as the truth. And this truth is a path that will remove obstacles and purify confusion into wisdom. Now, since only the three jewels and Lama are indivisible, protect that effect within us. Let's engage in the path as it's been explained to us and by the teacher and the lineage. And we can do this by refreshing our refuge. So if you'd like to just recite along with me. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now to stabilize and enhance the wish for enlightenment, we'll recite the four immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. The next prayer, the seventh prayer, is a summary of the complete path to enlightenment, acknowledging what we need to abandon and what we need to adopt. So, being certain that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present with us. We think that reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So here we're going to make an offering now to the merit field in front of us. This is the short mandala. And here the essence of it is to just let go of the clinging to ourselves, our resources, and our merit. And so we let it all go, and in the letting go of it appears a wonderful land where all living beings can take the teachings. I think this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as the Buddha field of Offic. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Yidam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyatayami. So we release the Offic. It's accepted by the merit field, who smiled at us in delight. Then the field of merit that surrounds the central figure of the Buddha begins to dissolve and melts into the figure of the Buddha. But I think here the figure of the Buddha is in fact the teacher that you have greatest affection for. And that an emanation now leaves the teacher's heart to abide above the crown of your head. The emanation descends through space, entering the crown of your head and coming down to rest at your heart. And all the good qualities of the teacher now begin to expand as light which fills your body. Then the light goes out through the pores of your skin, filling all of space. And any idea of inner and outer self and other vanish within this light. And wherever there are sentient beings who exist within space are transformed to become fully enlightened beings. Now the qualities of enlightenment which fill all of space begin to withdraw, and now they come back into your own heart. You feel yourself embodied sitting on the seat, and you're breathing normally and naturally, and you acknowledge that you have the potential within you to bring about your own awakening and the awakening of every other sentient being. And you think that you're going to, and that you are offering up your time to learn about these teachings and to put them into practice so that you can practice the perfections authentically, easily and consistently. And breathing normally and naturally. Inhale deeply. And then exhale. And allow yourself to come back to be present in your seat. And we'll begin the class now. So you can see we're up to the second class. And we're going to have a little look at what we covered. So we have this, there's a word we call the other six parameters. And parameter just means perfection or having reached perfection or going beyond the end. So in the Pali traditions and the Sanskrit tradition, there are 10 perfections presented, but they can all be subsumed or condensed into 6. And these perfections are the means of our awakening. So when we begin to practice the perfections, the emphasis really upon our own spiritual development. And this is the process of training the mind. And then once we have trained ourselves, we can begin to help others spiritually develop in a more, in a better manner than what we're doing now. So these practices are to develop the mind and to become a perfect Buddha are called perfections because they are done not only for the accomplishment of our own goal. If they were just for ourselves, we'd just call them practices. But when they're practiced because we want to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of others, then they're called perfect. Because they're the perfect essence of the Mahayana path. We found last week too that the perfections are presented differently within the Tibetan traditions. So when you read books, say, presented from Lama Tsongkhapa, like Galamrim Chenmo, for instance, as one of our basic texts, he presents the perfections in a particular manner. But other teachers, say, for instance, from the Nyingma tradition or the Shakya or Kagyu traditions, present their perfections in a slightly different way. So you might get different names and not only that, but different things to do within each category. So we talked about that last week and we mentioned the benefits. And the primary benefit, of course, is to bring about our own enlightenment, whereby we can help others effortlessly. So today we're going to look at these the perfection of generosity, or also called the perfection of charity. Find out like what it is actually. Acknowledge some more of the benefits. Look at how we begin to develop it within ourselves and then how to practice and some of the divisions. Now you can see there's quite a lot there. And I was getting this class ready, I kept thinking, oh, there's not enough. And anyway, this morning I've been thinking, wow, there's too much. So we'll just see as we go. Because there's a great section here called In the Beginnings of How to Develop. It is really interesting. So we'll just see. I might just slow it right down and we do that. And then next week we look at, take some of the other things in particular, the divisions.
Eddie, also, I have a suspicion this might be the old PowerPoint file. It's not the new one.
I'm not sure what that means.
I think it's not the one that we edited last night.
No, it is, because this one here that I'm looking at, I didn't do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, in brief, you all know that there are 6 perfections, and that the first is generosity or charity. Then is the practice of ethics. Then patience. Then we have the perfection of joyous perseverance, concentration, and finally wisdom. So they're in this order because they sort of build on one another. So like the former produces or influences the subsequent one. Like for instance here, we begin with generosity, and then that will have an influence on the practice of our ethics, our ethical conduct. I mean, that will have an influence on our patience and so forth. So why is generosity put first? So generosity is put first because in order to help others, they must relate to us. So the practice of generosity is like sort of like waving out and going, hey, look, I'm coming here. And in our gestures to come here, we're indicating that we want to give them whatever they wish for. So in the commentary to the Middle Way by Chandrakirti, he says every sentient being wants happiness. And there's no human happiness without wealth. Understanding that wealth comes from generosity, the Buddha taught generosity first. But so if you think, I think this makes really good sense because, and there are many, many countries around the world where people have less resources than we do. So there's many, many people who are starving, for instance, don't have food, don't have water, lack shelter. They lack just all the normal, ordinary things that we have in abundance, just to be what we call happy. So if we were to sort of like go to those countries or be within those countries and have the wealth as we do as Westerners, and we see these people suffering, they think, oh, these people are suffering, I'll teach them the Dharma. You know, I don't think we might not make too much progress doing that. You know, however, if we would offer them some money to buy food or even provide food for them or give them clothes or some sort of shelter, extend our generosity towards them, you know, immediately they would appreciate that. And sort of think of us as a friend, a likable person. So we need to establish that sort of relationship first. And then independence upon that, we can sort of lead them into the Dharma. I think, you know, we have that there. And then often when you give things to other people, people like that. And they often think that you're a good person, a nice person for giving something to someone else. So that nice, good person is like the ethics. You're not harming them, and you're not being stingy towards them. Yeah, so there's one too. Then we are sort of like patient towards them. We understand that they probably don't know any Dharma or something. Nobody sort of wants to sit there and listen to us pontificating about, you know, the Buddha and the three jewels and things like that. So we sort of have to be patient with it and then sort of be enthusiastic and gradually lead them into the teachings of the Buddha. Now, for ourselves, when we look at some of these topics here and in our own training, we sort of have to ask ourselves questions too. And some of the questions we need to ask could be, what are the afflictions that I need to be particularly on guard against when practicing any of the perfections? Then what are the antidotes to that affliction? So in charity, for instance, or in the practice of generosity, there are a number of different afflictions that can arise, a number of different obstacles that can arise. And I think, you know, the most common one is just you don't want to give, you just want to hold on to what you've got. And so that's an actual obstacle to the practice of charity. So you just go, oh, well, that's called stinginess or clinging to what I've got. What's the obstacle? What's the antidote to it? So, you know, we've got to sort of ask ourselves these questions and know the answers. And that way we can actually begin our development and begin to practice better and better. Now, today I'm using a lot of material from this particular book, The Great Treatise by Lama Tsongkhapa, Lama Chenma, but also the commentary on it by Geshen Sofa and another commentary put up by Geshen Tashin Siri. As you can see here some of the books that I've been using. I just about to show you the covers and we just leave it there, unless you have a question about them. This morning I was reading the Six Perfections by Geshen Sonam Rinchen up there in the top of the green book. And I also recollected that in the Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Thupten Lhogen, there's an excellent section on there and showing how each perfection is related to the others and is contained within them. So I'll go back to that and have that material ready. I mean, I've got it here, but I'm just wondering if it's too much material to present, but we'll see. So let's begin with a quote. So Lama Tsongkhapa said, "The nature of generosity is the intention accompanying bodhisattvas, disinterested, non-attachment to all their possessions and their body. And motivated by this, the physical and verbal actions of giving the things to be given." And this is, of course, taken from the Lama Chenma, Volume 2, on this particular page, 114. When we look at, so this is of course from the Sanskrit tradition, and in particularly Gelupa tradition of the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist teaching. But from the Pali tradition, generosity or charity is the attitude which bodhisattvas give material things to all beings so that the others might be happy. Without investigating whether the other persons are worthy or not. So we have something that's sort of like, it's very similar here. Because in the Pali tradition, it's the attitude with which bodhisattvas give material things to all beings. You see here, this one is saying, is the intention accompanying bodhisattvas, disinterested non-attachment, the intention. So the main aspect in the practice of generosity is the mental aspect, the intention to give. So the practice of the perfection of generosity entails sort of generating in various ways the intention to give and steadily increasing this generosity, even though you may not be giving away something to others. Of course, it is, of course, to be able to give at the end your body, the teachings, a whole lot of different things, anything that others ask for. But before we can do that, we have to actually sort of train the mind to be able to do that. And this training is done in various ways, as you'll see in our class today. So many of you may have heard of the great yogic practitioner called Milarepa. And if you know, like, so he lived for a long time naked in a little cave on a hill, and sort of, I think all he had was a bowl, until his sister made him a white cloth to cover his nakedness. Yet he was able to generate and cultivate all of the perfections. Now, yet he had really nothing to give, otherwise all he did, he could go out and grab some more nettles off the hillside and cook them up and make some nettle broth and offer that to anybody who came by. I think most people had more than that themselves already. So this is sort of like an example of even though you're not physically giving something, the perfection is primarily reliant upon the intention to give. And so something else, so sometimes perhaps others, or when you first come to the practice of Buddhism and you hear this term called the perfection of generosity, it might, just the term itself, might have you thinking that it's to be able to give away everything to everyone else, and it always sort of abolish poverty. So that people have everything that they need. But of course it doesn't. So His Holiness says in his book that Buddhism, one teacher, many teachings, being generous does not mean abolishing all the poverty in the world. If we have the wish to give but lack resources, there isn't any fault. Each situation in which we are requested to help needs to be examined individually, considering our motivation, our capability, and the repercussions of our action. So these things here, motivation, capability, and the repercussions of our actions, will be talked about in more depth as we go through the course. Now, why give? Why be generous? Why practice charity? And one thing is that there are many, many benefits for doing so. And as many of the Buddhist teachings, the structure of many of the Buddhist teachings in terms of mental is they often start with the benefits of doing something and the faults of not doing it. And so that's what I've done first. I just put up a slide and said, let's look at some of these benefits and acknowledge them. So first is resources. So these resources apply to ourselves and to others. So it might seem a little bit funny when you're saying, well, how do I get, you're saying I need to give away things to get resources. That's a bit strange. So, and it is, does seem a bit strange. So if you look at ourselves, we look at ourselves, and you ask yourself honestly, do you think you will become enlightened in this lifetime? And if your answer is no, I doubt it, then you have to acknowledge, okay, then I will die in this life, and then I will be reborn and have another life. And in that other life, I will need resources. I will need clothing, a house, some sort of job, something to help me stay alive and engage in my path, because I didn't attain enlightenment last life. And if I don't have food, clothing, shelter, good people that support me, it's going to be very, very difficult to attain enlightenment again. So when we make our offerings, when we give things in this life, we're giving it with this intention to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And so we want to give because it brings us closer to enlightenment. And in the giving, we put into place the causes that will bring the resources in future lives. So generosity or giving alleviates poverty, and it provides ourselves and others with the necessities of life. Ourselves, of course, necessities in future lives, others in this life. So generosity ensures that we have the material resources needed to practice. to engage in its perfection and experience its results in future lives is important. His Holiness, again from the book Buddhism, says that lacking even one of the resources will limit our opportunity to progress on the bodhisattva path in future lives. So, when I look back over my own life, and I'm just thinking of another young man who came here. So at one stage of my life, so I was homeless. Now, I was very lucky, even though I was homeless, because I had some dharma that I could actually call upon and keep quite a happy mind about being homeless. But it's very, very difficult to actually practice happily when you are homeless. So at one stage there was a young man that came to the centre, and he was homeless. He had a pack on his back and he ended up sleeping in our driveway. And then he ended up sleeping on the front path just outside the centre. And we sort of had to chat to him. And anyway, then we offered him underneath sort of things so he could get some shelter and not sort of freak out the people who were coming to the centre when they walked down the driveway, you know. And then we offered him a place to have showers here and things like that.
Because Eddie, I'll just jump in there. When people were walking down the driveway, it actually looked like there was just like a dead body lying there.
Yeah. So, you know, so we offered him some resources, and I actually gave him some money so that he could go up and get to a place where he could have a shower and buy some food and all that sort of thing. You know? So it's hard. It's hard when you don't have the supporting resources, when you don't have friends, when you don't have a home, when you have little food. So, you know, that might not be the situation we find ourselves in at present, and that's only because of the practices of generosity we practiced in the past. So we want to have the good situation we find ourselves in at present. We need to keep doing these things now. Now, there's another wonderful benefit of the practice of generosity. It produces a sense of fearlessness. So one of the things you always find that you become fearful of is that your resources could be stolen or lost. Right? But if you've already given them away, there's nothing to be afraid of. In fact, there's a verse that says, from giving, you become fearless. From stashing your wealth, you become fearful. Dissatisfaction, communality, and always needing protection. If you give, these faults will never harm you. Mundane happiness, meaning basically that you'll find that when you offer things to other people, when you practice charity, you're quite happy. It's a lovely thing to give resources, to give things. Like for myself, but you know, like I like going to the movies, but I find I enjoy myself so much more at the movies if I've got someone else to share my company in the movie. Or if I go to a concert, I love to buy two concert tickets to take someone else to it. Yeah. And I'm sure you find you'd be the same. It's so much more enjoyable. So in that way, yeah, in this life, we're happier. Now, of course, in terms of super mundane happiness, here we're talking about the happiness of how it can bring about Buddhahood itself. So again, one of the verses says, generosity brings worldly and super mundane happiness. Not giving brings suffering even in this life. Human wealth is like a shooting star. Even if you do not give it away, it quickly disappears. Human wealth is like a shooting star. As Ari Shanti Deva said, the perfection of generosity is said to be the thought of giving to all beings your possessions and your merits. Thus, the perfection of generosity is dependent on the mind. So once again, just a reminder, it's really this intention to give. Now, in the Pali tradition, you know, I said before, generosity was the attitude with which bodhisattvas give material things to all beings so that others might be happy, without investigating whether others are worthy or not of the offering. The bodhisattva's practice of generosity is to give without any expectation of future reward. So this could be the future reward that others would repay our kindness, or even that in future lives they will have the resources. So even though we know that, you know, it's just like, well, it's just cause and effect. You know, it's just like you plant a seed and you water it and you've got all the good conditions, that seed will grow up to be a good, a tree with all the fruit. It's just natural. Well, all the same, I was saying that it's natural. At the same time, we might be thinking forward a bit and go, oh yeah, then I'll have a really good fruit tree. Then I can do this, I can do that, but it's my fruit. Yeah. So here we have this idea of giving. We know there are future rewards, but we don't focus on that. We don't have the expectation of it. So giving without expectation is more than a simple willingness to give whatever belongs to you. It means also that the merit or goodness created from your act of generosity is also given to others. So that giving is that's sealed, or we're reminded of that in the dedication. So when we practice the Mahayana, we are praying that all of the our past, present, and future merits will act as causes for others to be happy, healthy, free of poverty, attain liberation and attain enlightenment. And and there should be no partiality, no bias between friends, enemies, and strangers. So this is tricky because, okay, so we know there are benefits to for being charitable, but we've got to have no hope for that benefit for oneself. So that's a sort of tricky line. The benefit will naturally come to us. We don't need to have any hopes for that. So I think what's going on here is that by having no hope, it's a way to stop clinging to things. And also this idea of expectation that we have, the natural idea of expectations that we have.
Eddie, that's what's mentioned in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, you know, when we read it about how a bodhisattva has no expectations and doesn't say I'm a great bodhisattva practicing generosity.
That's right. This is in line. There's the bodhisattva who thinks I've made this offering is not a bodhisattva.
Yeah.
If you think you've made these offerings of charity to others, then you're not a bodhisattva. Yeah. So this is Geshe-la Sopa says this. He says, in the beginning, it's natural to think that I can't do this. And not only do we think that, we also think, I don't want to do this. But then he says, look, don't get discouraged. Because there are some people who can do this very easily. There's some that it takes a bit more effort, and there's some that's just very difficult. And what we need to remind ourselves is that this practice really depends upon a mental training. It's depend upon the training that the mind will be developed. So if we haven't trained ourselves, of course it's going to be difficult. Of course, if we're going to have these an inclination to think that I won't be able to do it. So we just have to accept that. But then come back to yourself and ask yourself, why am I thinking like this? And the answer is really simple, like, well, I haven't trained. But it's just a natural thought to have. But if I could train myself, then I could. Because everything just depends upon training. And the lovely thing here, remember, it's just mental training. Start off with just mental training. Geshe Sampa goes on to say that through repeated training, the mind will become accustomed to the perfection of generosity. And when this attitude becomes spontaneous, one will have the perfection of generosity. But when the mind is not trained, well, the perfection doesn't exist. So it's not easy to train the mind, and especially in these practices, these perfections, as I'm thinking about how I practice myself and sort of getting I'm shocking myself into my how I'm not so good at it. And there's a lovely metaphor that's coming up to describe how this how I'm not so good at it, and it's to say that this is common to everyone. So we begin to develop it, and as you can see, the beginnings of development depend highly upon mental training. And we're going to meet obstacles, and these obstacles will have antidotes. So let's look now at some of the obstacles, and then we'll have a look at some of the antidotes. Well, they're both here.
Yeah, Eddie,
this is not the one.
No, it's not the one, I told you. But it's okay, it's just that there's no pretty picture. The information's there.
Yeah. But that's really weird, because when I put it up on the screen, I just moved the whole thing across, cover it right across. Okay, they're all here. So, obstacles first of all. We've got miserliness and stinginess and then attachment. So these miserliness and stinginess are just aspects of attachment. They come out of attachment. They're aspects of attachment. And then we have an obstacle called not seeing faults. So this is referring to the idea that we do not see any fault in not giving. So we hold on to what we've got and we see no fault in that. Seeing
faults. But what's the, is that miserliness or stinginess or?
That's all of them.
Oh, it's all, okay.
When we don't see any fault, and then the rest follows. You know, then we are miserly, we are stingy, and it's arising out of attachment.
Right.
It's like, sort of, like it's, in a way, it's like having attachment to our, so here are the major things we have attachment to, right? Our body. We have attachment to our body. We have attachment to our resources. And we have attachment to our virtue. And we see no fault in offering the body, the resources, and our virtue. And that is because we have attachment to our body, our resources, and our virtue.
So Rosemary's just brought up an interesting point that we often kind of justify it or see it as being careful or thrifty.
Yeah, well, thrifty is a good word, isn't it? That's right. So say it again, Rosemary wrote and said the two things
We see it as being careful or thrifty, yeah. Like kind of justifying it.
Yeah, so So we do need to be careful and we do need to be thrifty. So we are careful and we are thrifty. And in the meantime, we keep training our mind to give more and more. And then we find that we require less and less for ourselves. But the most important thing to be careful with is the mind. And we certainly need to be thrifty in like protecting the mind.
So Chris has also said it's like on a bigger level, say preparing for retirement, the future resources that we need. Yeah. And I remember Geshe Toshi Sering talking about this, that we can't kind of be foolhardy. We have to prepare, but it's such a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's like that. So we need to be intelligent about this and be reasonable about this. So if we're, like you say, so we are preparing for our retirement, but like you look, so what does that mean? I suggest what it actually means is retiring from the rat race of going to work 8 hours a day and doing and staying within the mundane concerns. The rat race of we're going to retire from relating to the world as if it is the resources to provide me with my happiness. That's what we've got to retire from. Otherwise, we'll never retire, but there will always be things to do to try and be happy in this life. So, this is this thing, if we really look at this from where we are right now, and we're really honest with ourselves, and you start going backwards, you go, okay, so these perfections are developed upon having the mind of enlightenment. Do we have the mind of enlightenment? For myself, I have to say no. Do I have the mind of renunciation? I have to say no. Am I actually, when we look at the stages of the path to enlightenment, and we look at the practice called the four thoughts that turn the mind towards the Dharma, do I actually have a deep understanding so that I appreciate the fact that I have this life with its leisure and opportunity? If you ask yourself these sorts of questions and then look at your behaviors, you'll find for most of us, we are like the analogy we're going to talk about shortly. An elephant that keeps diving into a dirty and muddy pool. That's what we're like. But before we come to this analogy, which is we're coming up to the end of this, and then I'll bring it up. To combat these sort of things, miserly stinginess, attachment, and not seeing faults, the first thing is we go, what are the faults of being miserly? What are the faults of being stingy? What are the faults of attachment? So, you know, when we look at attachment, one of the tricky things here is to check and see what your own mind does. Does the mind naturally go to, when you hear this word attachment, just like holding on to something, being attached to something? Is that what it normally does? Because if it does, remember, that's only one aspect of this meaning of attachment in Buddhism. Attachment is really saying, I'm overestimating the good qualities of the subject. Then you can ask yourself, in what way am I overestimating the qualities? And then you can sort of say, well, they seem to be coming from the object itself, independent of me. It also seems that this object is going to actually make me happy. You also say, you know, the object's all good. When I'm looking at it, it just seems all good. And it'll always be good. And then in relation to all of those, then there is this other aspect of like the clinging to it. And this is the normal meaning of the attachment word we're most familiar with. I don't want to be separated from it. So we've got to bring in quite a lot of knowledge here in terms of this word attachment. And, you know, remember that.
Eddie, I think there might be some questions about this. So do you want to go to the...
And then so, you know, like, so what are the faults when we are engaging with objects in that way? So, okay, so let's just, we've got the faults of holding on and then the faults of attachment. So these two, like I said, it's all arising out of attachment. Miserly stinginess comes out of attachment, and you're not seeing faults is also an aspect of attachment, the ignorant aspect of it. So does anyone have any questions just about this, these faults of holding on and the faults of attachment?
I think Rosemary does. So do you want to just stop the share and we can put on the gallery view?
Okay.
No,
here we go. Rosemary.
Hang on, I'll give you all the power to unmute yourselves. Right. So, Rosemary, theoretically, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Anyway, yeah. It's just that by the time I finished typing, Eddie's either onto the next bit or he's solved the question I was asking about, so it just looks like I'm really slow. So what I'm thinking is I'm thinking specifically when we talk about generosity, we think go to resources first. And I'm thinking, well, you know, like I said, well, you know, we kid ourselves, oh, well, actually, I'm just being thrifty, or then you start thinking, well, being generous, do they deserve it? But it comes back to the motivation. And I'm guessing the attachment to money very often might not be the attachment to the money or the resources itself. It's the attachment to the security that we think it will give us in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be, oh, the security that I can go to Dharamsala to go to teachings, or I can do something else with it. But really it's that need to hang on to what you hope is going to be future happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Is that comes into it, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And my other question was, can you talk more about the generosity of offering our virtue? Not having any, you see, I've got absolutely no idea how this would feel.
So, in terms of attachment, there are so many different things that we're attached to. The body is one, of course. Resources. So resources can be physical resources, but also like mental resources. Yeah, one of the mental resources, of course, is virtue. And also some of the resources we have are mental resources.
How does that work? How do we offer mental resources, and how would we be stingy about it?
Well, suppose one of your resources is to feel secure.
Mm.
You're really comfortable with yourself.
Mm.
So one of the ways of offering that to others is to make others feel secure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it could be as simple as that. interesting thing here. So this is said a lot in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and it also says it comes up a lot in other sutras on wisdom. And actually, it's also said in the Four Noble Truths. He says, you know, although although there is suffering, there is no suffering that exists. Although there is like the practice of, although there are things to give, there is nothing to be given. So I like to hear those sort of things, because it really challenges and brings into clarity how things actually exist. So it's just like you said, Rosemary, like, you know, and you go, well, how would I do that? How do you give away your virtue? So when we say virtue, like, it must exist. Right? You can't give away something that doesn't exist. Right? So the other question is, okay, well, if it exists, how does it exist? So this goes across, like, whatever the phenomena is, we should ask ourselves, how does this thing exist? Whether it be suffering, virtue, whatever, the path, whatever. Yeah. Now, how it appears to exist is, it's real. But it's something that actually really exists, doesn't it? What do you think? Does our virtue seem to really exist?
Yeah, okay.
Right. So that's where we start. It really exists. So we're going to question that. We're going to have a look and see, like, if it does, well, where is it? Where do you think it is? Yeah,
that's right. I don't know. You can't tell me.
So when we go to look for it, we don't find it. No matter where you look for it, you're not going to find it there. Does this mean it doesn't exist?
No.
You might think, well, yes, it doesn't exist. If I can't find it, it doesn't exist. But we'd be wrong. That's a mistake. We're given things that do exist, not things that don't exist. So the things we exist, that's funny too when I said that. What we're not giving is inherently existent virtue. Mm-hmm. Objectively existent virtue. We can't give that because it doesn't exist. We can't give that. And that's what, you know, in the Heart Sutra, in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, they say, but bodhisattvas don't actually give virtue. They don't actually give these things because these things don't truly exist. And then they don't cling to even the word, because that's how things do exist, in name only, merely. Because when we, like I said, when we search for them, we will never find them. Like, why? Well, a couple of reasons. One is because they depend upon other factors. So when you look for the thing, you find other factors. You look at those other factors, you find something else. But then what you hear, really, all you end up with in the end is words. Words and ideas. But those words and ideas have effects. don't they? Yeah, they produce effects. There's this really fine sort of line, and the line, of course, is always blurred and crossed over because of our clinging, because the natural way the mind goes is it's just not familiar with that. You know, the things that appear to us in our using our words, suddenly they take on an existence that's more than that. You know, it's really think about, isn't it? If you think about, you know, suppose you do something good, you are actually generous. There's a feeling that arises and depends upon your generosity. You know, this other person is happy, like, wonderful, great. Also, you know, this could also be a cause for me to have resources in the future. So whenever you say those sort of things, like resources in the future suddenly appear to be true. Right? This happiness that the other person is actually experiencing, they are experiencing happiness. But it's like if you go try and find it to point it out or anything like that, there's nothing there like that. So, when we talk about like the faults of holding on, these are, you know, the faults are all arising because a virtue or happiness, any aspect of the path seems to truly exist when in fact it doesn't. So that's from the side of the wisdom aspect of it. That the side of how merit and how generosity exists and so forth. Now, even if we forget that and are generous, there's still benefit. It's like polluted with the clinging. It's polluted with the wrong view. There's still benefit, though. But it doesn't bring us to like enlightenment or liberation or anything like that. But because it's polluted. But it's still good. It's a good activity. It's, you know, we call it good karma. Good actions. And they are. All we're saying, what I'm saying here is that those good actions don't exist in the way they appear to us.
Carolyn, do you have a question? I know you're struggling there. Did you have a question? Just unmute yourself.
Yeah, now I can't find my question.
I can hear you, Carolyn. I can hear you, but you can't find the question.
Yeah, that's right. So, in response to Rosemary saying that, she didn't have virtue,
I was being flip.
Yeah, but I did. If it is about, though, you know, that all can exist on the conventional level, doesn't it? Eddie, and it exists on the conventional level because, you know, for example, Rosemary's virtue, you know, does have an effect. Your giving of virtue to others has an effect at a conventional level. So when the quote you said, Eddie, about giving exists but it doesn't exist, that's sort of going between the conventional and the ultimate, isn't it? So we have to be very careful to realize that at a conventional level there's the cause and effect that, you know, as you said, that's important, but at the ultimate level. So how do we go between the two levels when we're trying to understand the perfections?
Well, one thing you can always do is go that whatever exists does so conventionally. Anything exists does so conventionally. There isn't anything that ultimately exists. That's the first thing. You also have to acknowledge that although this is true, everything exists conventionally, things appear to exist ultimately, meaning truly, inherently. And now we can't stop that. Even bodhisattvas on the 10th ground, same thing is happening to them. Things will always appear that way to our senses. So we need to remind ourselves that's an illusion. That's illusory. That's like, what is this holy, Lama Zopa says there? Like you're sick or something, you're hallucination, you're hallucinating. So these things don't truly exist, but they do exist. So in three principal aspects of the path, up around the 10th, 11th verse, you know, like Lama Tsongkhapa's got this great thing where he says, which is really different than all the other traditions, he says that when appearances arise, you're reminded of emptiness. When emptiness arises, you're reminded of dependence. Mm-hmm. So like I said, whatever appears and exists does so dependently. Like, for instance, here, the act of generosity. So what's generosity depends upon? Anyone?
A substance? Having
a
substance.
You've got to give something, isn't it? Something is offered. What else? Come on. You all know.
Yeah, a giver. A giver.
The giver, that's right.
And the recipient.
And the recipient. What is it? No one has said this yet. What else?
Intention to give.
Sorry?
The intention to give?
The intention to give, thank you. That's it. That's the actual essence of it. We've got a giver, a recipient, a gift, and the intention to give. Now just take out one of those and is there an actual generosity there?
But don't we also talk about the generosity of people we receive stuff from at a distance, or the generosity of a mother giving birth, even if she's a unsuitable mother? I mean, that doesn't necessarily include an intention to give, does it? I'm sure you're right, but I'm just trying to clarify it in my mind.
Yeah, we just call this giving.
Yeah, because
so here we're talking about the perfection of generosity, remember? Mm-hmm. Not just giving.
And people can give in a distracted manner or a corrupted manner.
Yeah.
So, you know, just a parent bringing up a child is continuous giving, whether you bring mindful awareness to it or not. But this, so for the perfection of giving, you need to have a bodhicitta intention. It can't just be
giving.
Yeah, just a kind of general kindness. It's got to be informed by something else, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay. So I was mixing up the giving and the generosity, whereas for giving, it's got to have the bodhicitta intention and all the other.
And intention to give to bring about enlightenment.
Mm.
This is the whole crux of the thing, the intention to give. So, you know, a better way to come to this. So, Rosemary, there's a great thing about like mothers giving birth. So it might be that they give birth. It's like they have the intention to give this to become enlightened or something like that. Probably not. They could have, but, you know, in general, probably not. Yet there is a giving that's taking place. From our side, there's a great... if we're practicing bodhicitta, this is a wonderful thing to remember. Because it means that the resources you have, which are your body and mind, are not actually yours. They've been given to you. But so everything that we have is like, you know, not ours. We use it. So there's a single slippery ownership. Now, there's another thing too. So even if we one of the major things, of course, is we could get an attachment through using the wisdom side, but we could also get an attachment through recollecting impermanence. So that nothing, we ourselves, the mind, the object, are all in flux, all changing.
Eddie, may I just make a contribution just regarding the benefit of fearlessness? Because it appears initially as if that's one of the obstacles, because, you know, we have to overcome the fear of giving something away that we believe is, you know, we probably need ourselves, you know, for future benefit. I gave the example of, you know, retirement. You know, we have to build our nest egg and protect our nest egg, etc. That's our mindset. So quite interested to hear about, you know, how do we turn the fear, Eddie, into the benefit of fearlessness?
Okay.
Thank you.
First of all, by having one of the things here, Chris, in this instance, in this case, you'd say, so tell me, what have you prepared for your retirement?
So Eddie, the stock standard thing is we have a super fund. You know, we pay down our debts and then we accumulate some cash to probably supplement that and then put something aside for our children. I think that's generally sort of a stock standard approach.
Okay, so just keep those ones there. And so when you have that thing and you keep an eye on it, can the sense of fear arise in the rise and fall of the stock market and what you've got and the things that you're holding on for future?
Well, I'll say yes.
Anxiety and fearfulness. And you go, why? Because it can be lost or diminished in all sorts of ways. So in that way, we have fear in regarding these resources. But the real question is, like, how can we be like fearless about it, isn't it? So the answer is really simple: don't have them. If you don't have them, how can you be fearful about losing them?
Well, I would say it's okay for you to say that because we're in Australia with a safety net. But
so, Miffy, before you got your those sort of things, the things that you had, before you got the money to invest in the stock market and blah, blah, blah for the future, were you afraid about losing them?
No, but I was still afraid of like...
Yeah, but not about losing them because you didn't have them.
Yeah, but then you're just afraid of the other things, like of not having...
That's right. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
But that's not afraid about this particular thing. There's always fear. It's just all different sorts of objects. So in here, the story here is, in relationship to these objects, if you don't have them, you cannot be afraid of them. So there's two ways of not being afraid of them. One is, you just never have them, so you can't be afraid of them.
So that's like a life of renunciation.
And you give them away, so you don't have them anymore, you're not afraid either. Did you get it, I hope?
Yeah. No, but that's just saying that's like the life of a renunciate. That's what renunciates do.
That's right. And what we're really renouncing is not so much the thing, it's the fear. That's what we're giving up. It's the fear. Of what? Of the loss of the particular thing that we had. But if we like, so what, you know, one of the antidotes, of course, is fear of losing something is to give it. I'll just mention these things, right? So, in terms of the antidotes, so, you know, one of the faults of holding on to our resources is that we do not get the future benefit in terms of other lives. So that's one thing. But even in terms of this life, then people could criticize you and you get, you know, all the negative stuff that comes at you because you have perhaps more resources than others, or you're more well off, more comfortable, all that sort of thing. That happens, you know, even today in our lives, people become jealous of us because we seem to have more than they do, than them, you know. Actually, now I'm just sort of thinking of like what happened in China, you know, before Mao Zedong came to power and the Communist Party took over. So, you know, so people had resources and were very happy to have them. They thought, well, this is really contributing to the happiness of my life. Yeah. And then the communists came to power and was like anybody who had anything was actually an enemy of the state and of the people. And these people need to be taught a lesson. So what was seen to be a resource providing happiness in this life suddenly turned out to be not the case. So even, you know, that's one thing. But then the other is, of course, of this idea, if you hold on to what you have, you don't offer it, then, of course, then you don't get the benefits in future lives. Now, remember here, what we said at the beginning, this is the thing that just keeps slipping by. It's the intention to give. So, like I said, you can have all these things, but intend to give them away. The fault isn't in the things. It's in the attitude that you have to them. Like I said, the attitudes of stinginess, clinging, all these sort of things. So that's what we're really working against, the clinging, the stinginess, that sort of thing, mental attitudes. So to go against it, we mentally give them away. Until, of course, you know, you can develop the strength to actually physically give them away. So, Geshe Sopa says, you know, that the psychological obstacle to generosity is wanting to hold on to things as our own. So, I think this is really interesting, especially when it comes to your body, holding on to your own body and its parts. So forth. So thus it includes miserliness, stinginess, and attachment. And destroying the sense of miserliness from the root is still not enough to complete the perfection of generosity. Because even the Hinayana practitioners do that. So we need something else, something more. And what is that something more? It's love and compassion. So you have to actually give with a sense that of love towards others, to directed towards others. You want them to be happy. That's why you're giving these things to them. You see that they are suffering, so you give these things to them. So like I said, I think that when this is discussed, we sort of hop straight to the actual by giving, physical giving, when this is not really where we need to be. We actually need to get to the part of the mental giving. He says, one needs something positive in addition, great compassion and love for others. One must want others to have freedom and happiness. So in addition to meditating on the disadvantages of attachment, we contemplate the benefits or the good results that come from sharing. It takes repeated analysis of both to develop a spontaneous desire to give. He goes on to say that generosity begins with a mental practice, an understanding of impermanence, and compassion will arise from analytical meditations. In other words, you really need to be thinking about this quite a bit. When one comprehends impermanence clearly, one knows that sometime one will part from everything that you have stored safely at home. Compassion has us thinking that these things are suitable gifts that can be given to others. When one mentally dedicates these things to others, then they come to belong to others. So I'm just remembering when I was reading this, when my wife died and had all the stuff that was left in the closets, all of her stuff that was there. And I was thinking, wow, you know, we could have actually physically given that away. We did it. I did, of course, after she passed away. That's what we do. But I was thinking, could have done it before she passed away. And with a sense of joy, thinking, this would go to here. It was going to go anyway, isn't it? We are going to be separated from these things. We're even going to be separated from our body. So the body, all the resources, we're definitely going to be separated from them. That's just a fact. So can we, like, even sitting at home, mentally give away everything that surrounds us that we call ours? I remember films and books where, you know, a man and a woman are together and one of them is dying. And the person who is dying will say to the person who's living, I want you to be happy. I want you to find someone else and live a happy and meaningful life. So it's like this is like the, you know, giving away the spouse, letting go. Okay, so we're not going to get to the end of this because this is really exciting stuff I want to share with you two now. And so in terms of the antidotes, we've got to acknowledge, you know, what are the faults of holding on and the benefits of giving and the faults of attachment. This all really comes under the faults of attachment. We hold on and we don't want to give because of attachment. So we need to look at the faults of attachment, how it's a really faulty mind, it misleads us. And so in that way then we can see the faults of holding on and then the benefits of giving. We also need to bring into that the fact of impermanence, that nothing stays the same, everything is changing, and you will be separated from your resources and from your body anyway. Right? And if you want to have the benefit of your merit, then it's like offer it. Other things we need to become familiar with, of course, are love and compassion towards others and faith in our path. So, gosh, I don't know how the heck this has happened. So then Arya said, again, another quote says, my body, likewise my possessions, and all the merit I create in the three times, I give without any hesitation at all in order to accomplish the aims of all others. So someone who truly wants to benefit others is a bodhisattva, and they practice generosity. However, this does not mean that beginners have to actually give things physically. It does not mean we should give up our possessions or our life for stupid reasons. No. And by that, we have to understand what should and should not be given and when that process takes place. And this will all follow in the text, right? So as beginners, it's really hard to even give small things away, much less our body and life. So to do this, of course, we have to train the mind. We have to try it again and again and again to create the desire to give. And if done from the heart, then this kind of practice turns away attachment to one's belongings, and it reverses the thought of holding on to things as mine. When this attitude is really strong, then you won't have any difficulty in meeting the needs of others. But if your mind is not trained to do it, then it'll be very difficult to do it. So not only that, we'll be able to judge when it is best to give and when it is best not to give. When we choose not to give, our decision will not be based on stinginess. It will be based on skillful means. So let's I'll hop out of this here, the screen saving thing again, stop share, and come back to you on the normal thing. And I just want to take you through a reflection. So all of you are probably sitting in your own house and in your own room. If you could give away everything in the room before you died to somebody that you really cared for, who would that person be? So imagine yourself giving all the possessions into in the room, saying, okay, this is your house now. Now you're giving this room in the house or the house itself to them because you want them to be happy. This is love. And you wish to diminish their suffering. That'll be the compassion aspect. So this is someone you like and care for. Now I want you to imagine giving it away to a stranger. Think of someone that you know, maybe the shop assistant, maybe anyone that you don't really know, that's not family, not related to you. So you want that person to be happy. You want that person to experience less suffering. Can you imagine both those things taking place when you give them in your house, in your room? Imagine if somebody did it to you. Said, hey, I've got this great house. I don't want it. You go, who are you? You said, no, you don't know me, but I wanted to give my house away to a stranger. And it's you. Take my house. You can share it with your family. So in the summer, I go, wow, very, very happy. So you think, okay, I'll give this room away to a stranger. Now think about someone that you really don't like. Somebody who's difficult to even be thinking about. Now what way, you want this person to be happy, why? You want this person to experience less suffering. You want their suffering to diminish. Why? So here, take my house. Okay, so let's just stop there and I'll ask you, so you know, take off your unmute your things and what came up for you? This is all we need to do in the beginning. We just need to start thinking about this and doing this mental exercise.
So Linda, your first cab off the rank, what happened?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was lovely to do that. So I gave away originally to my daughter because she won't earn a lot of money. As a vet, so she but she can do a lot of good. So I gave it to her first, and then gave it to a girl who I attempt to help at school, who has absolutely nothing. Her parents have drug addicts. She has nothing. And I thought that would be really nice, give it to her. That was really exciting. And then I gave it to a man I work with who's really difficult. I've locked horns with a few times because he's so hard to get along with because he's so miserable. I thought maybe if I gave him my house, it might make him happy and he wouldn't be so hard to get along with.
Yeah, that's good. Anyone else? Anyone find someone to be quite difficult with?
Yeah, well, I thought I'd give it to Trump, but then I got really sad for Trump because I thought even if everybody gave him their houses, it wouldn't make him happy.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking of Campbell Newman, but he was only getting my room. He wasn't getting the house.
Jeanette, you need to unmute your thing.
Is that it?
Yep.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yep. But your picture's vanished.
Oh, how do I get that back?
Hi, Eddie.
Caroline, you need to unmute too if you want to talk.
Is that me now?
Yep, Jeanette. Hey.
There you go, mate.
Hey, Willie. Okay, Jeanette, go for it.
I gave my house away to my daughter because she's just got married and she's struggling a bit. She needs a car and she's pregnant. She needs a car. The middle person, for the life of me, I can't remember. I did give it to somebody, but I can't remember who it was. And that's only 5 minutes ago and I can't remember what I gave it to. But the last person I gave it to was my sister-in-law that hasn't spoken to me for about 15 odd years. She doesn't like me at all. Mm-hmm. But I could give her my house, but the thought that came into my mind was, but what about me? I'd be left with nothing.
Yeah. Okay, so the way to combat that thought is to take this idea that I'm going to die and we'll all be left behind anyway.
Yeah, I know, but what do I do in between the time that I give it away and I die? I might not die for a long time.
That's right. So this is the one where it says later on... So this is quite a natural thing to think, and then you can say, so I can't give it away right now. Because there's a right time to give these things. We just can't, like, give it because we want to, and then put ourselves out on the street.
Mm.
Right, so it's we will find we have objections to this, and then we've got to sort of look at those objections and sort of use reason again.
So, Eddie, is this exercise then that if we did this, you know, like we do the mandala offering, so we're giving mentally emanated offerings. So if we got familiar with giving our house away every day to different people at the time, just as a mentally emanated offering, it would make it, I mean, it's kind of cheating, but it would also mean that we get more used to it.
Yeah, remember here we're getting used to the idea of giving. But like I said, you know, when I asked you, it's when we talk about, we have to not only just combat stinginess, we actually have to give it with love and compassion. Right? So I really like this because love here has been, we want them to be happy. So, you know, like we give it to our own daughter, we want them to be happy. We give it to the stranger, we want them to be happy. We give it to the difficult person, we wish them to be happy. The other side is, of course, you know, when I said to you, in terms of compassion, why do we want them to suffer less? Why do we want their suffering to diminish? Any ideas?
Because they're living beings, and they just want to be happy like all the rest of us.
Yep, that's got to the other side of the happiness thing, the happiness side, the loving side. They do. Everyone wants to be happy, and no one wants to suffer. So it's a really simple reason, and it comes out of the equanimity meditation. We don't want others to suffer because it is suffering. It's that simple, and nobody likes it because it's suffering. We wish to protect them from suffering because it's suffering. No, we don't want to suffer. They don't want to suffer. They want to be happy. We want to be happy. So we go, why do I want to protect you from suffering? Because it's suffering. I love that reasoning. It's like really easy. Not too hard to remember. No one wants it.
So one is a question, I guess, and I guess when I was thinking of who to give it to, I kept on thinking of more than one person. I found that really difficult. And it just raises the question, like, I give to quite a lot of organizations every month as a sort of sustaining subscriber, whatever they call it. Mm-hmm. And because the research shows that people who already give are the first target to ask to give more. Mm-hmm. And so they ring up mm-hmm. often to ask me to give more money per month.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and I've mentally chosen across, children, animals, the environment, social advocacy, Buddhism, etc. And I just sort of feel like it just is hurt. Like I sort of think, well, am I being miserly? Am I being stingy saying not at the moment? Or like, how do you do it in, you know, when you already give like that? Am I just being stingy or how do I? How do I process that in terms of generosity?
And it's tricky also because part of the vows is to give when asked. So this adds another layer of complexity to it.
Yeah.
Now this is why it's really important to start with we don't do this, but most of us, like I said, as normal as ordinary people, we give first and not much thinking before it, right? Or the thinking is, I agree. But then just like you say, Caroline, once you start giving, and then people go, oh, this is a person who likes to give. Great, I'll ask them too.
Mm.
Right? And then we find that we can't give anymore. We have a natural sort of resistance to it. Right? Our boundaries are sort of, the giving is sort of met, right? So this is why you'll see as we go through this, it's much more important to want to give than to give. Like your thing will be like I want to give, but I don't have all the resources that I can.
Mm.
I'm sort of getting squeezed in here. So that'll be like a sort of a natural thing to happen to us. That's why it's much more important to want to give. To keep developing the intention to give. So with this, Caroline, so whenever you find those things that you can't give at the moment for this type of organisation and so forth.
But the issue is I could. I mean, if I wanted to, but I choose to then give more to other causes. Like I'd make a decision that, well, I'd give you more, but if I'm going to give more, I'd give more to Buddhism because that's sort of got, so there's sort of, it's not just straightforward that I don't have the resources.
No, that's right. And this is why, you sort of have to look at not just what is intentioning, but what is actually given.
Mm.
Because when you look at things, it's like the best resource of all to give is the Dharma. Because that actually gets at the root of suffering, provides the very best form of happiness.
Mm.
So Eddie, also it seems there's a like a balance between having the substance and the intention, because as people ask for more money, that's for more of the substance, and then we then our, you know, our intention has to go up, and if we say no to more substance, then our intention gets less. But it doesn't have to be like that, does it? You can still have a wish to give, but not give more of the substance of it, because otherwise you end up backfiring and giving more of the substance and then regretting it, and then that's like double demerit. So, but they're really tied together, those two things, of the intention and the substance. As one goes up, the other does, because we don't differentiate between them.
No, that's right. And then of course, the thing of going, yeah, so with this one came, I thought, okay, so this is also, you know, something happens in our chest, at our heart, because, you know, we can't, you know, like you say, I'm putting it here, but you're asking me for here, and there's an effect that takes place. You know, so once again, we can bring the wisdom aspect to that. You know, if your line is just in this areas here, in terms of the actual physical giving, that's fine. But then the mental giving should be beyond that.
Yeah.
And in terms of how we feel, then turning the wisdom in on, like, who's feeling this? Where is this feeling? So we keep bringing the wisdom aspect back, and then flipping back out onto the conventional side again. We nearly finished.
It's okay. We don't have to finish the PowerPoint today.
I think many of you have probably taken bodhisattva vows. After reading this material, it's like really sort of shocked me into how easy it is to damage the vow in relation to this really simple practice called the perfection of generosity. Because when we're practicing this, it's like everything I have, the attitude to take, which we have to develop, is that, like, for where I am now, right, these clothes, they don't belong to me. They belong to others. The food that I eat, the chair that I sit in, it's not mine. It's come to me through the kindness of others. And it's only on loan. Everything that I'm using is for their benefit. It's not mine. Now, I forget that as soon as I get up. When I go to buy new vests like this, I look at it for me. I damage the vow. Every time you do that, it's a mistake. So this is really shocking to me. Oh, my God.
Because even our body is on loan in this way.
Body is on loan. And the body came to us, as you point out, Rosemary, through the kindness of others. All the great thoughts we have, the virtue, is through the kindness of others. In particular, I'd never met Kinsa Rinpoche. I'd never think like this. I'd never have an insight into the essence, this nature of the body and mind. None of it. You know, they say that even a cool breeze on your neck when you're in hell is a result of virtue. You know, what's the cause of virtue? You go, the Dharma. Where's the Dharma come from? The Buddha. So those are all like kindnesses. And when we take on this role of the bodhisattva attitude, then it's for the sake of others. And everything we have has come through the kindness of others. So, you know, this morning when I was sitting outside just preparing for the class, and I realized, oh my gosh, there's so much to talk about this. We're not going to do the class. It's, I think, even up to where we are now, you could probably do another whole class just on this section here before even doing what I've done, you know. So, you know, I think, so, like, when we take, so how to, like, practice it, how to use it. So when we take refuge in the morning, you know, the refuge is not just for ourselves, is it? It's for the sake of others. Yeah, we are taking refuge so that we can lead others into refuge. That's the practice of generosity. That's a generous action. And I was thinking, I mean, those of you who've taken the Bodhisattva vow, and there's a practice called Succession Guru Yoga, where it's so easy to damage these vows. Succession Guru Yoga is about, really about repairing all the different vows and making sure you're squeaky clean, you can continue on. It's actually should be even more important than the practicing the sadhana of Higher Shloka Tantra. So when we go to practice Succession Guru Yoga, there's a section where it says where you go to retake the vow. And it goes something like this. Guru, Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas, please listen to what I now say from the depths of my heart. Just as all the Buddhas of the past have practiced mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, so will I too for the sake of all others. Da 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 da. Goes on, right? So if you do it just like that, if you pick up the sadhana and read that verse just like that, you have not repaired your bodhisattva vows. Like, why not? This is because you have to imagine in your mind that the teacher in front of you, you know, your own teacher appearing as the Buddha, is saying to you, Guru, Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas, and then you repeat after him. He says it, you recite, you repeat. If you don't think that he's saying it to you, you've not retaken the vow and repaired it. So I'm thinking, wow, that's an act of generosity. If you think that your teacher is there going, you know, you've done, I forgot to acknowledge that the shoes I've got on my feet, the food I've eaten, it's all for the sake of others. All of this is to benefit others. I've just thought about it, me. Or I haven't even thought about it at all. That's damaged the vow. So we need somebody to help us repair the vow. We need to take it in front of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or a statue representing them, or your teacher, or an image of them. But that, you, at the same time, you put the image up, the statue up, and so forth, you must imagine that person is saying, okay, Eddie, you want to take that, retake your vow and repair it? Say after me. Well, I've forgotten that often. You know, I read the thing, I read it through three times, but I've forgotten that I need to say this in front of my teachers appearing as the Buddha after he gives it to me. The vow is like given, and then we take it. So now I think that's an act of blessing, that your teacher gives you the vow. Now, it's also an act of generosity that you take it that way. Why? Because your intention is to bring others to enlightenment. So when I read this, I was like, oh my gosh. So, but yeah, occasionally I remember. Lots of times I forget. So they use this analogy where it's like this elephant who's really sort of really hot in the sun, and he just wants to get nice and cool, right? So he goes down to the pool and he leaps in the pool and he rolls around the pool. He makes it all nice and cool, has a great time. Then he gets out and he rolls around the dirt again. He gets all dirty again. And he's walking around and he's like, oh my God, the heat, the dirt, the flies, I've got to clean up. He looks back in the water again. Right? Dad says, oh, so nice in the water. He gets out, he gets all dirty again. And I go, Jesus, that's like me. You do it right one day, or 15 minutes, or 10 minutes, and then it's forgotten. The next act you do, you're dirty yourself. You know, I remember, oh, that's right, I'm wearing this clothing for the benefit of others. I buy that vest to bring joy in the mind of others. I remember, okay. But then I go down and buy the groceries and I forget. Now it's like the groceries are for me. So easy to forget. Yet all those things that could be acts of generosity. Remembering the kindness of others, repaying that kindness. Yeah, well, I'm going to leave you there because there's a lot to think about this. I think for those of you who've been engaged in the study, in the last couple of teachings that we listened to, Caroline, we were downstairs. So there's material about this that you guys probably have already, and you might even have it on MP3. Especially this analogy of the elephant getting into the cleaning himself up and then getting dirty, cleaning himself up and getting dirty. You become aware of how much. We want to be bodhisattvas and have this attitude, how easy it is to be ordinary, how to make it about ourselves. It's like this funny thing. I mean, for some of us, our parents have died, right? But the body that we have came through our parents, through the kindness of our parents. And, our parents suffered. They didn't know how to be happy like we're learning how to be happy. And so, for most of our parents are still alive. So what are we doing with this body for them? This mind that we have, it's continuing, beginningless. All these other sort of persons had the mind, did all these great things. Here we are now with the mind. The person called Caroline, the person called Eddie, Jeanette, Chris. Now we have this mind. And if it's working okay, it's through the kindness of others. Now, those others have also taken rebirth. They're probably around us somewhere. We just don't recognize them. But what are we doing for them? We can at least imagine that we are giving our house to them. We can at least imagine that we're offering them the things that they need. And by doing so, we get to fulfill the wish that we have to become actually authentic bodhisattvas. Anyway, just something to think about. We'll finish up today there. In terms of your reading here, so from pages 114 to 120, volume 2, Lamrim Chenmo, 114, 120, those of you who, like Chris, Caroline, you guys were, we were doing that Lamrim study downstairs. When you read this again, you'll recognize it. others, Geshe Sopa, if you have the book, it's in volume 3, page 255 to 276. I'll just give you the heading of this. So this is just called How to Train in the Perfection of Generosity. This is a Geshe Sopa book. It looks like this. It's page 255. This is where he got this great analogy of the elephant, and there's a wonderful material in there about how we keep working against ourselves, when we really don't know what we're doing. What's I going to say now? I think we'll just stop there. If you guys have anything finally you'd like to ask, if you're not, we'll dedicate the merit and I'll see you again.
All good. Time to dedicate.
All good. Okay. So, due to the past, present, and future merits of practicing these perfections, which are like a dream, yet exist in mere name, which are created by ourselves, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and all sentient beings, who also exist like dreams in mere name. May I attain enlightenment in defense upon these perfections, which exist in mere name, and lead all dream-like sentient beings who exist in name only to that enlightenment, which is like a dream and exists in mere name, by ourselves alone, which, while not existing from the side of the body and mind, does exist in name only. So I just say thank you once again for all being here and encouraging me to study, because I'm really enjoying it, and I really love enjoying I love it and enjoy sharing with you this material. So I hope you like it, and we'll try and practice some of the exercises. So thank you once again, everyone.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.
I got the page number for you.
Put it into the chat, Eddie, so everyone can get it too. If you know how to do that. Just a reminder that it's every fortnight that we have the classes, so make sure that you get your registration in time. So and if anything goes wrong at all, then just always email and I'll eventually be able to get to the email. And a special welcome to Jeanette, because this Jeanette hasn't had any internet since April. And this is her first ever online class, first ever Zoom meeting. And look, she's already like at it like a pro. So, and it's just so wonderful to have you, Jeanette. I'm really, really thrilled to welcome you back. So, Eddie, what were the page numbers?
So you wanted page numbers for this week, wasn't it? Not last week.
Meta wanted from last week.
Okay. From last week, Meta, just read from page 228 in Geshe Sopa's book. Oh, sorry, so you won't have it. It's called Explanation of the Process. Just go from...
you could just email it, Eddie. That's okay.
So, Metta, go from the title's called The Fixed Number of Perfections Based on Their Subsuming the Entire Mahayana. It's called The Fixed Number of Perfections. So, look for that. And for us,
thank you.
For this week, Geshe Sopa's book, page 255 to 276. And it begins with the title, What Generosity Is. So that's in Geshe Sopa's book, volume 3. Otherwise, if you have the Lamrim Chenmo, it's from page 114 to 120, and this is volume 2.
Okay, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Good to see you. Bye.
Bye, Caroline. Bye.